what I'm doing. I'm praying right now. And I'll let you know what my prayer is. My prayer is, God, if you ain't here, we're screwed. I'd like to thank the committee for taking a chance and inviting my wife and I here to share. And when I say take a chance, they didn't know what I was going to say, neither do I. But I would like to think this is a great honor to be one of the speakers that starts off this inaugural meeting. I was sitting here thinking a minute ago, and I don't get too serious because I don't like that. And this is called the Northwest Pockets of Enthusiasm. And my addition to it is born on the spirit within. That's where it comes from. I believe that. Because I'm enthusiastic about this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm absolutely enthusiastic. You know, the most amazing thing I have found out in this program, and if you want to know, I've heard them. I don't want to be too different. They've all got up here so nicely and told you when their sobriety days were, to let you know. My sobriety date is September 6, 1967. And I'm most grateful for that. And I know it's only by the grace of God and slowly but total, complete surrender that I stand here today. I'm a dummy. Because I also like to know, I'd like you to know that I have a genius type mind. I have the kind of mind, and some of you may not have it, but I have the kind of mind that makes puking make sense. If you think about it, it's got to make sense because you find the rationale to keep doing it. So that's a great mind to do that. Make going to jail make sense? So that's, you know. Paul said, I'm kind of kicked back. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not to listen to me. Real simple stuff. Don't listen to you. If you knew when I tell guys and those that you don't know what to do, I'll tell you the first thing, quit listening to yourself. And it makes sense. See, because I don't like to dig. I'm not that kind of dig. Because I'm the kind that I just complicate everything. I won't just let it be. I got here in 1967, totally beat. Alcohol beat me to death. Alcohol. Nothing else. I didn't come here because of the tiddlywinks. I came here because alcohol beat me to death. I remember distinctly the thought that ran through my head. If I stay on this stage 1 second longer, I will die. I remember it clearly because, you know, I had a 25 in my shirt. I had a 45 under the seat of my car and nobody was after me. But I also knew if I stayed on that stage 1 second longer, I would die. I knew that without question. And I had to come back to Southern California, to Ruby, you'll hear her, and tell her she was married to an alcoholic. And at that time, Ruby thought, I've been up here in this town singing and carrying on. Somebody reminded me the night of today of the hotel. I was trying to think of it as the Rid Pass. You know, I played, and there was one up here called the Davenport. You know, I played in all those cool upholstered sewers, you know. I played those things. But you see, Ruby never knew she had married an alcoholic because when you're cool like I am, and you can lie good like I can, you know, what's the point in telling her? If she knew what I was like, she'd run. I didn't want to tell her what I was like. She didn't have a clue. You see, because I'm cool. God, I can lie. If I didn't lie, I had such wonderful inferences going. I'm such a master of half truth. You know. I see you shaking hands. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Yeah, I can tell her half. You know, Because if you lie, you got to remember it. If you tell a half-truth, somebody else will supply it. You know, that's the kind of guy he was, you know. So I couldn't tell if he was married to an alcoholic. And the day came when alcohol beat me up so badly that I had to come home and tell her, honey, you're married to an alcoholic. And she thought my problems were girls. I like girls. Scared of them, but I like them, you know. And they had a right to be afraid of me. And I didn't come to, I'd come in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out really that they were just as afraid of me as I was. But I never knew that. You couldn't walk up to a girl and say, hey, honey, would you like to go out with a wimp? Because that's how I felt. I felt like a wimp. You can't say, honey, let's go out tonight. I'm a wimp. You know, she's going to say, get lost. You can't walk up to another guy and say, hey, look, dude, I feel less than you. Like, hey, you know, you can't walk up to a guy and say that, I feel less than you. Because he's going to tell you, well, man, what you need to do is get your stuff together. And he never knew that's what I've been doing, trying to do all my life was get my stuff together. And every time I try to get my stuff together, it meant going back to jail. It meant going back to a nut ward. So if you're new, if you're old, it's not about getting it together, I found out. Because if you're sitting here, you got it together. That's why you're here. Yeah. It's not about all that stuff that I thought was so necessary to live. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time in 1950, and if you think you want to worry about how old I am, I'll tell you, I look good. I'm 70 years old, and I want to give you some new information that black don't crack. That's why it is. If you look, listen, I'm just me, that's all. I'll tell you, let me tell you something. I have the most glorious time in Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't worry too much because I found out that's a waste of time. Total waste of time for me to sit still and contemplate my neighbor with, oh, I wonder what's going to. I know where I've been. I know where I am, and it's none of my business because coming after that. You know, some people say, I don't know where I'm going. If I knew where I was going, I'd tell God to fix it. So I don't know where I'm going. It's fine. Just fine. Absolutely fine. And that's the most exciting thing in the world, not to know where you're going. Because you see, I love living on the edge. I love it. It's wonderful on the edge. You know. And you sit right there, you don't know what's going to happen. And most time, I don't know what's going to happen. It just evolves. And I'm saying, wow, I could have died, never known this one, you know. And it's the most exciting thing in the world, that I can stay sober. I don't worry about much of anything. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God, and he's the caretaker. Let him do his job. Let him do his job. I'm going to try to do what he wants me to do. Let him do his job. He'll do it. Positive of that, he will do it because he has done it. I have the track record that tells me he does it for me if I just do what I'm supposed to do. I find out we have a business deal, if you will. You know, it's a 90-10 deal. I love that. Only difference is it's different than any business deal, you know. You see, because I'm the 10% and he's the 90%. And it makes it so easy to just do your little 10%. Don't drink, go to meetings, and help your brother. That's what you're supposed to do. Not climb the high mountain, not become a millionaire. Do something that's simple. Stay sober. Be of service to God and your fellow man. Be of service to your family. Be of service. That's what this thing is about. That's what I found. And the more I'm of service, the better I feel about me. The better I feel that my father takes care of me because the track record tells me that. In 1950, I had been arrested 20 times. I had been in 4 nut wards. I had lost a wife with two children, and I stood before a judge. I heard Jack talk about Guadalcanal, and the chaplain was down there. Well, I told the judge I was one of those sailors that was down at Guadalcanal fighting with Colonel Carlson's 2nd Marine Raiders. Now, I'd never been there, but the judge didn't know the difference. Because the judge at that point was about to sentence me to jail for a year. And at that particular time in my life, jail stopped looking good to me. Now, if you're like I am, the first time I went to jail, I was very indignant. How dare they arrest this black man and put him in jail when he's a newspaper reporter. You know, I had never written a story, but I was a newspaper reporter. You see, alcohol, I have found, changes your attitude. Now, by the 20th time I went to jail, I had begun to say, oh, hell, who doesn't go to jail once in a while? Altered attitude. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does, too. It alters your attitude about you, about your fellow man, and about God's world. It alters your attitude. Spiritual, if you will, because that's what it says is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not original. I'd like to think I'm original, but I'm not. You know, it's in the book. That's what it says. I used to hear people walking out there, I'm trying to live a spiritual life. I said, what are you talking about, spiritual life? And something spiritual happened to me. And when you've been born and heaped and steeped in religion like I was, see, I come from one of the Pentecostal religions where you just gave your life to Jesus all the time. You know. And they talked about, you know, I didn't know what to do with that stuff. You know, they said, and Jesus said this, and Jesus said that, and I wanted to know what Mom and Daddy said. Because I didn't know who Jesus was. And they said, well, I'm going to meet my Maker way over yonder on the other side. Well, I could relate to that because I was having trouble right down here, you know. A lot of things didn't make sense to me when I was a kid, you know. And so when they start talking about spiritual, when I got sober, I thought they were going to pull out some tambourines and we could do some holy roller stuff that I know so well. Because I knew all about religion and spiritual life because I had seen it lived in front of me. I would love to hold my mother and father hostage. I love to do that because I did it for a long time. If I hadn't been raised in that church, I wouldn't have been this way. If they hadn't done this or done that, I wouldn't have been this way. I wouldn't have been an alcoholic. You know? I'm an alcoholic because I drank alcohol. If you want to know how to become an alcoholic, you've got to drink alcohol. Now that may be news, but that's what it is. Couple that with a spastic elbow and you're doomed. Now, I had a brother who lived in that house in, I guess, reasonable contentment. But not me. Not me. My brother, my father would say, I'm going to beat you, he'd faint. I'm the kid you had to be. And I wanted to do it and get it over with so I'd get back to what I needed to do. I hated it when they would say, I'm going to get you. And he'd wait. And I'm waiting for that thing to hit me. Do it and get it over. Don't put me in this kind of suspense. And he'd look at me and say, I'm going to get you. I mean, day in and day out. And I'd be doing one bad thing after another. And he'd promise me. And I'd say, Mother, why don't you do it? Let me get on with this stuff. And eventually he wouldn't. He wasn't too nice about it. He used to make me take all my clothes off and do it, beat me. The Bible says, spare the child, spare the rod, and spoil the child. And they'd hearken and hearken. That's what the preachers would do. Spare the rod. And the most amazing thing was that's how I grew up, and that's what I found that I passed on to my children. I passed the same stuff that my father did to me on to my children. I reacted to them the same way. I have a daughter. I may jump around tonight, but that's how it comes to me. I have a daughter. We're going to see her pretty soon in May. this girl was supposed to be, by our will, she was not supposed to be here. She was supposed to be aborted. But God saw fit to bring that girl here in spite of us. I mean, in spite of us. Because I'm a destructive human being. Make no bones about that. I'm destructive, sober as well as drunk. I'm almost 28 years sober, and I'm still a destructive human being. The difference is, in my life today, I own it. I no longer lie about it. And in accepting me as I am, because you have done that, enabled me to make different kinds of choices. Because that's all I want. I want a different choice. That's what I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to react in a manner to life in a manner that will kill me. I make a different choice. I cannot remove one defective character because I'm powerless. I have no power, none. I used to hear people with alcoholics and say, well, I'm working on this defect, and I'm working on that defect. Well, I tried it. And the sucker kept coming back. It had a new ribbon on it, but it was still the same one. And finally, I had to give up. And somebody pointed out, Milton, it says, we ask God to remove them. Not Milton. Oh, yeah? That was like, where was I? Where was I when... And I read this book. And I see what's in that book. And I try to live that way. But where was I when that happened? Here I am trying to work on this defect. I remember distinctly. I remember what I could do when I first got sober. That was in 67. I found a quick, glaring character defect, lying. God, I could lie. And I said, aha, that's one thing I'd work on right away. Okay? I didn't know my life, my spiritual life had begun. I didn't know that. I thought, oh, a lot of it comes after I do all these things. But I didn't know my spiritual life had begun when I admitted to myself that I was an alcoholic. That was a change of attitude. That's when it began. Some people say, well, I'm waiting for it to happen. Baby, if you're here, it has happened. There is, you know, we walk around saying, I'm waiting for the miracle. If you're here, it's a miracle. You know, that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can look all you want to, but the fact that you're sitting in this seat, oh, you know, sober hand, drawing sober breath, that's a miracle. Because drunk I'm supposed to be. And I sit here, and you sit here, and let some mealy-mouthed fart like me sit there and talk, and you sit there and look at me. Well, what you don't know and what I have found out, because you're willing to listen to me, I heal a little more. Because the healing isn't in the talking. The healing is in the listening. So my prayer is, God, make me a better listener. Not a better talker, a better listener. And that's hard if you're an alcoholic, because you know everything. It's hard to sit and listen. And I had to learn how to do that. It's not something just swept over me. I learned that from my wife, and she's an Al-Anon, and she's a... I was telling who, Paul? Or somebody today, you, Mike. Marry an Al-Anon, and the game's over. You can't run them games anymore. And she taught me about listening. I remember distinctly when she taught me the lesson. I had a knack of whenever you get me kind of pinned down and you're kind of cornering me a little bit, I have a knack of balling my fists up. And she would say, you're going to hit me. I said, no, I'm not. I'm ready. You know, and when they start at you, they don't start with one question. It's a barrage of questions. Just one after that. Just come on now. And you can't find the answer to the first one. That's frustrating, you know. And you're trying to answer, and there's more just piling on. And all at once, you want to say, shut up! Let me answer the first one. And I remember this one time she said to me, Milton, I got something I want to tell you. And she said, but you get on that side of the bed, not get on this side of the bed. She put the bed between us. And she said, what I want you to do Just listen to me. Don't defend it. Don't give me an no excuses. And you don't have to change. Just listen. Let me tell you something. That was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. To listen to my wife. And she said what she had to say. And I just want to say it. I just want to fix it. I want to just, I want to come up with those excuses. But I listened. And I began to understand. Because I could listen, I was forced to listen, she began to heal. And that's what I began to learn how to do, to listen, so that my fellow man can heal. Because if I knew the way, if I knew what you should do, I wouldn't be here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We seem to think that a sponsor knows everything. He's a drunk. Thank God, he's a drunk. You know? And you know, I don't sponsor people. I tell them I'll be your best friend. I ain't going to judge you. I'm not going to waste my time doing that, but I'll listen to you. And I'll share my experience with you. Now, you do whatever you choose to do. Because I don't know the way you should go. I know what I've had to do. And I'll support you even when you're wrong. And that's what I find it's all about. I can love that, call that loving a person without condition. Unconditional love. That's what I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was talking about this daughter, Roseanne. I don't want to forget her. I'm going to let you know what I was like in sobriety. In sobriety. This same girl who was supposedly aborted, she got here. And I found myself chastising her just like my father did me. She would do all things. I have a picture of Roseanne in a potty chair, asleep, where I was trying to force her to make poo-poo. And I look at that picture, at this child sitting there, and it just almost brings tears. But I was forcing this child. I was being a nasty daddy. That's what I was being. And I didn't know at that time that I was using some of the same stuff my father would use on me. And through the years, little by little, she's a wonderful, beautiful daughter. She's now expecting her first child. And she's coming to see us in May. And she's coming so her mother and father, she lives in Chicago, she's coming to Vancouver for her grandmother's birthday party so that her mother and father can rub her belly. Rub that belly of that kid she's carrying around with her. You know, and I know today, without any shadow of a doubt, one more drink and I'd have missed it all. Just one more. You know. Anyway, we had this growing family life. Got here, they said, 1967. We had this family. I had to learn how to live. I didn't know how. I got a job. And the job was beneath me. Job I never would ever take. Because I had problems. I had big problems. You know, one of the problems I had is I didn't like being black. And it was obvious I was black. Because there was something bad about it. I didn't wear a hat. I'll tell you, it was just 3 years ago that I started wearing a cap. And Ruby's telling me now she's going to bury me with a cap, you know. And I wouldn't wear a cap because white guys never wore caps. Out in the snow and all that kind of stuff, never wore caps. So I didn't wear a cap because I wanted to be like them. That's pretty difficult. But that's where I was. And the other thing I would do, I didn't want to get any handkerchief head jobs. Now, some of you may not know the expression, but that's a black expression. Handkerchief head job is a yassa boss job. Yassa. You know, you've seen the caricatures. Yassa, and pushing a broom. You know, just, and say, yassa boss, The guy, Willie Best, is an all-time movie actor, is one of the best. And I didn't want anybody to think of me that way. I read newspapers out loud. I saw my diction wouldn't be flat. I'm going to say no dis, dim, dat, and those. I said this and them and that and those. I made sure you thought of me as being a different black. To make a long story short, when I surrendered the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing God did for me is put a broom in my hand. And if you can imagine, I was in show business, and some people around the Hollywood area, they knew the group I was with and all that kind of bit. And can you imagine? Here I am walking down, pushing a broom down Santa Monica Boulevard, Mr. Showbiz. I'll tell you about that broom, though. Pushing that broom down that street enabled me to go to my meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Pushing a broom was not Milton. I've come to know that. I'm not a broom pusher. I know how to do it. And I began to slowly understand that God had given me that just simply to get me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how any and all jobs ever took on with me in my life. It's designed to get me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not to get rich, but just get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got here in 1967. The first guy I met was a guy named Wendell. I called him the other day. And Wendell 12-stepped me. And Wendell said to me, Milton, you can make it in this program. You can buy a simple concept. And that concept is that if you can understand that all you've ever learned in life, every plan, every scheme, your greatest thought you ever had, all those things brought you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're totally invalid, will not work for you. He said, it might work for someone else, but it will not work for you. And of course I was indignant about that. Here I'd been halfway around the world entertaining thousands and thousands of people who just thought I was wonderful. And here's this guy telling me my genius had brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I always thought I was, I'm serious, I thought I was smart. You know, when you get broke, and I was born in New Jersey, when you get broke, rather be broken, your genius mind says, go to New York and sell a pint of blood. That's smart. And I made it make sense. And I said, ah, boy, that's sharp. That's the kind of head I had, you know. But Wendell had short-circuited me. And at first I was kind of indignant about it, but I thought one second more. You see, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with one thing I knew in mind. If I would be willing enough to do what these people told me, I could stay sober. I knew that going in because I had experienced Alcoholics Anonymous in 1950. I had the experience of taking a guy to the program, and he was still sober. And to me, he was Newark, New Jersey's worst drunk. But you see, I had to admit that I had to be willing to do what these people told me to do. Not believe it, didn't matter. Some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to believe it works. You haven't got to believe it works. That's not a requirement. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with that thing called willingness. And I thought that second, that 1 second. And I said, oh, he's right. I cannot put the word success behind my name. I could not say Milton Merle success. But I could put back that Milton Merle drunk. He had me because I had to be willing. And then he said to me, Milton, tell you something else. He said, stop listening to you. And because I'm a smarty, you know, I said, well, who would I listen to? He said, everybody else except you. I said, well, what about my wife? He said, and her too. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me some instructions. Stop listening to you. And I had to stop listening to me. You know, think. I didn't even apply that. I just didn't listen to me. See, I need simple stuff. I don't need stuff I got to figure out. He said something very simple. Then he said to me, Milton, why don't you just do what you see sober people do? And I said, okay. Just do what sober people do. I one time asked him, I said, well, you know, I might become a poly parrot. And he said, well, it's better to be a sober poly parrot than a drunk one, you know. They used finely honed razors when I came here. They just cut the ground out from under you to keep you from dying, just slowly but surely. And you'd walk away, and you'd be maybe a mile or two away, and you'd feel the blood dripping in your hand. You know you've been had. That's how they treated you. Then he said something I would, you know, you get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you do all these things, and you think you're just, you know, you're just wonderful. You know, it's just so wonderful. You get sober, and you're going to meetings, and God, you think you're doing great, you know? And you're polyparrot. You hear people say things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you pick up the lingo. If you're new, there's a new lingo spoken here. It's a lingo that's not spoken in treatment centers. When you come from a treatment center, you have to start off at ground level for Alcoholics Anonymous. You start off at ground level because there's a new language spoken here. It is not clinical. It's one drunk talking to another. That's what this is about. And when I would hear all these words in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd hear people say wonderful things, and I put in my little word register, and I got that, you know. You know, you pick up these little things, and the more you pick it up, the more you feel like you're a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You may not know how to use it, but you know you got it. You know. And you know, I remember saying, you know, once in a while I would venture with Wendell and say something I'd hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd say to me, Milton, is it in the book? Because I can be flower mouth, believe me, I can be. He says in the book. And when he'd say that, I'd have to go back and pick up the book and try to find out if it was there or if it wasn't there. That's how he got me into the book. I used to take the book when I first got sober, put it on my chest and go to sleep. You know, I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, oh, I can't sleep. I tell them, read the book. When you know it, put you sleep, you know. And they recorded me in by saying, well, nobody ever died of lack of sleep, you know. And I tell guys, read the book. And they go to sleep. And then you complain about I can't sleep. But that's how I began reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I began reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and underlining the things that pertain to me. That's what I did. And I kept doing it. And I still do it. I want to tell you something. I read that book a lot. And 5 years ago, I was down in San Diego, California, with a friend that I'm working with today. And I had never talked in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous about living a spiritual life because I didn't know what it was. I really didn't know what it was. And I'd hear people say, I'm living a spiritual life. I didn't know what it was because I hadn't been able to refine it for Milton, to put it in a place that Milton could feel that in him. And I was reading the book, and on page 25 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have seen this page over and over and over again. And when God saw fit, he let my eyes see what Alcoholics Anonymous refers to as a spiritual way of life. I used to hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, AA stands for altered attitude. I never related that to being spiritual, but that's what it is. The book said so. So it takes its own time. You see when you see. You know when you know. And you can't rush this process. You know, I'd love to go to one of them fix-it doctors. You sit there and lay on the couch and he fixes it. I'd love to go to that, but I know I would lie to him, I would take him, and I'd turn him around. I'd challenge him like that. So I don't want to rush the process. I'm going to let it happen the way God wants it to happen. Because I'm God's kid. And God don't want anything but the best for me. I'm sure of that. And now in our lives, in our home, in our lives, we try to live the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous as well as others. We had to tell our daughters, I had to tell, we have another one, which Chrissy's be 24 years old, right? She's crazy. She's crazy. I love her. She says nuts as she can be. Feet planted firmly in midair. Yeah. She's adorable. She's absolutely, she could walk in this room and you, she has such a presence about her, she can walk right up to you because she's been around AA and Al-Anon. She can walk right up to you and say, my name is Christy Murr. And you'd love her just from the minute because she's so much effervescence about her. And she just captivates you. You know? And she's so full of BS, it's unbelievable. You know? And she'd tell you quickly, my father understands me. Because she knows, I know, I'm full of BS too. And she knows it. And I understand where she's coming from. You know? And you know, we've had to let go, and it's difficult to let go. We've had to tell those, I had to tell them, I don't know, Ruby's told them over and over again. I had to tell them, I don't know how to be a daddy. You know, when they're 13, they're crazy anyway. They don't fit anywhere. They just dangle. And when you're dangling, you're nothing. See, my problem is I forgot when I was 13. When I was 13, I found some Dago red wine. It growed me up in a hurry, you know. But they don't have any track shoes to run in, so they're not. I remember Roseanne was seeing, to me, her first boyfriend. And he was different. he was just the opposite. His mother and father's situation, just the opposite of what ours was. You know, his father was Chinese and his mother was black. You know, and it was just the opposite of what we were. And that's what they had in common. And he ran on a skateboard. I wouldn't talk to it. Because all I knew, I just knew it beyond any shadow of a doubt, someday she's going to get pregnant and come home and say, Daddy, here it is. And my head would say, well, what do the people in Alcoholics Anonymous think about us as a family? That's where my head was. And I did this over. She'd come in and I wouldn't talk to her. Ruby was trying to get me to be friendly with the little kid. I wouldn't talk to him. She had us go to lunch. And I wouldn't even, I didn't act like he existed, poor guy. You know. And that's all they had in common. It was a boyfriend-girlfriend situation. They had something they could akin to kinship that they had. That's all they had. But here I am in my head. Rating her like I would rate myself, I used me as a yardstick. And one day, when I just had about as much of it as I could handle, when I began to realize that I had done with her what alcohol had done with me. Whenever I drank alcohol, it predicted the conduct of my life. When I plugged into people, and I'm a great one for walking around with that umbilical cord hanging, I'd plug in. They predicted my life. They predicted the happiness and the sadness. I gave them power, and they never asked for it. I gave them power over me. And I realized that I was giving Roseanne power over my life. So I had to sit it down and get honest. And I had to tell Roseanne, I don't know how to be a father. And I said, maybe if you teach me how to be your kind of father, maybe we can make it. And that was a big breakthrough for me. Because she began to teach me how to be her kind of father. And this is the most magnificent thing in the world. I remember telling her, you know, my name is Milton. I said, you can call me Milton. She said, oh, no, Daddy, I can call you Milton. Oh, I can't do that. And about 2 weeks later, she walked in the house. She said, hey, boy. And it was okay. I'm going to tell you what I felt, because I'll never forget the feeling. When she walked in the house and said that, my chest just seemed to want to explode. She had found safety. She had found safe. She was safe enough to risk. And that's what the program did for us. I did the same thing with Chrissy. And Chrissy, because she's a blasé kind of a kid, she told me, oh, Daddy, you don't need any instructions. You know how to be a daddy. I said to her, Chrissy, write it down on a piece of paper for me, please. If you have seen it, I have. I haven't seen it yet. But that's Chrissy. But the amazing thing about it is that I was then able to be able to be a friend. Not equal, but a friend. I would take each one out to dinner, just the two of us. I wouldn't take them both together. I knew better than that. And I began to see the difference in my two daughters. Roseanne, when she would order food, they would order food for me. They would give me what they wanted me to eat. That's how they would order it. And the bill, Roseanne's bills, would always be much less than Chrissy's. Because Chrissy's much like me. She's flamboyant, you know. And she just orders, and it's at least $10 to $15 more when Chrissy and I would go to dinner. But the amazing thing about it, you know, I used to lay in my bedroom, in our bedroom, and Ruby would be in the room with the girls. And they'd be just chattering, this and that. I'm saying, what are they laughing about? You know, and I'd feel left out. I feel left out. I say, God, why can't I be that way? Why can't we get in the room and just laugh? I couldn't do that. But the amazing thing about it, God found a way for me to get closer. And we'd go out and have dinner. And then they would tell me everything I wanted to hear. Any questions I had about what their life was like, what their school life was like, I had to tell them the truth. I had to be willing to let them show me how, because I didn't know how. It worked for me that way with those two girls. I told Ruby, I don't want to be a husband. Show me how, and that's chancy. When you are married to a person who has a way to go, they don't mind telling you. They will tell you in no uncertain terms. And you got to not worry about the tone of the voice. Because if the tone of the voice, it'll get me. It'll get me if you come with it loud, because it scares me. What I've had to look is at the content. It's what she has said, is it right? And when it's right, I got to own it. That's the difference, I got to own it. Not defend it, just own it. To be able to say, you know, you're right. Because otherwise, before then, if you raise your voice, I got to deal with your voice, not the right or the wrongness of it. And that's the way our lives began to mesh. Because she began to be free enough to share her feelings. And little by little, because she shared hers, I would risk sharing mine. Because I knew if I shared my feelings, it might disturb something. It might cause something or some pain somewhere. But you see, she had taught me a long time ago to be able to share and not defend. And our lives began to get closer and closer together. I've had heart attacks. She's been there. You see, God sent Ruby to me in Portland, Oregon, 32 years ago. More than that, 33 years ago. It was God's gift to me. And I've come to know an Alcoholics Anonymous. She is God's messenger to me. Because she sees me like I don't see myself. Sometimes when you're sober and you're trying to live this program on a daily basis in every area of your life, and God, you think you're going 90,000 miles now. You've got it together. You know, you just AA and back. Just doing this AA thing. And she's standing on the ground saying, well, you're not so hot. I want to know what that not so hot is. Because I have a disease of perception. I see myself one way, and others see me the other way. And so in my mind, you're God's messenger to me. I want to know how you see me. Because I'm a guy that's full of illusions. I'm just full of illusions. I ain't the hot crap I think I am. I ain't the soberest guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a guy that's still trying to stay sober one day at a time, good, bad, or indifferent. And I need you. I need you to tell me what I'm about. How do you see me? I know people leave, well, I'm going from this home group to another home group. I don't want to do that. I want to stay with that group because they saw me when I came in, and they said, well, the group's not doing the way I want it. Stay there and get it back to the way you'd like to have it. You don't run from groups. You don't get mad, well, they don't do it my way. I don't like the way they do it. You have a right in that group. They saw you get there. I want them to know that I'm there because when I got my head up my butt, I want somebody to pull my coat and say, Milton, your head's up your butt. Get it out. I I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and it just bothers me to see people flop from group to group to group to group. You know? And that, it just bothers me, because that group needs you. That's why you're there. And you need to be there. I've been in groups where it just change over and over and over, and somebody says, well, you stay there anyway. So I stayed there through these changes. I let them know how I felt and stayed there anyway. The strange thing, I go to a crazy wild group in Canada. They're nuts. They're just crazy. I'm the oldest guy there, and of course, my head, which has a contractor on my butt, believe me when I tell you, says to me, they're too loud. You're sober now. I've been made the alternate delegate. And my head says, well, you're the alternate delegate. You should be in a group that's more involved in service. Now, I'm the oldest member there of that group. I've been sober longer than anybody else in that group. I got shamed into being there. Just shamed into it. I had one of these loud, you know, these young, loudmouth, eager beaver alcoholics. His name is Ron. He used to say to me, well, Mills, when are you going to join my group? And I said, well, I've been sober a while. Why don't you tell me to join a group? I know to join a group. I wanted to shut up. But every time I'd see him, he'd open that mouth of his up. And so just to keep his mouth shut, I joined the group. But you know, my head says you don't need to be there now because you're this and you're that. Now, I remember an old friend of mine came up from Southern California, and he said to me, Milton, you know, leaving groups is easy. But one thing for sure, it's better to stay where you need. And I needed that group. It's just that something I need. Because if God wants me to remove that group, He will do that. I won't. Something I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let God remove me, not me. You know? And I know through experience, God will place me where He wants me to be. Not where I ought to be, should be, or could be, but just where He wants me to be. So I can be of maximum service to Him. I'm right now working with a guy who has started as a program. He does main events. And he's asked me to come out and just share about serving others. The things that I've learned to do serving people. I've served people in business. And the wonderful reward of serving others. And where did I learn it? I learned it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I learned it. And it's the most wonderful thing. I've had to... I don't want anybody to get the impression that I've gotten so well. I haven't gotten so well. I'll tell you a little incident. Not too long ago, he gave me a $5,000 bonus. And my first reaction, oh, you can't do that. You cannot do that. I want to give it back to him. And I just went through a whole litany of, I'm just here to help you, blah, 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 blah. And I came down and I told Ruby about it. And she said, Milton, did you say thank you? And in just that little bit, what I wanted to do, and he wouldn't let me do it, I wanted to grovel at his feet. He said, oh, that's what I'm like. Today, that's what I'm like. I'd rather grovel and say, oh my God, you're so wonderful. His answer to that money he gave me was, I'll either have to give it to you or Uncle Sam. Simple. But I'd rather grovel. And I became aware of that's the kind of human being I am. Not that I can change it. It's about finding out who and what I am and what the kind of an individual I am. Now I've got to make friends with it. Not change it, just make friends with it. As my friend of mine used to say, make love to it. And the strangest will happen to me. I won't have to grovel anymore. I'll be able to say thank you, because it's really, I don't know how to receive. I don't know how to receive. I love giving, but I don't know how to receive. And that's something I've had to learn about, become aware of, to simply say thank you. You know when you have a dress on or coat, and somebody says, oh my God, that you sure look good in that suit. Oh, well, it's an old thing. That's what I'm like. And I've come to know that, little by little. I could talk on and on about Alcoholics Anonymous, but Ruby told me not to talk too long. Ruby is my higher power, and it's all right. I always tell people, Ruby wants to be the leader, and I say, lead on, honey. See, because I don't want to be a leader. I might act like I want to be a leader, but I don't want to be a leader. I might act like I want to be responsible, but I don't want to be responsible. I didn't come in this world being responsible. Somebody took care of me. That's why the program works so well. I got a caretaker. I've always had a caretaker. You turn my will and my life into the care of God? Yes, sir, right now. Because I love being taken care of. I don't like to be the leader. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, if she wants to lead, lead on, honey. I'm right behind you. Yeah. It's okay. So all this stuff about being a man and being a leader brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not about being a man. It's not about being a leader. It's about simply, as my deceased friend Chuck used to say, it's simply about being. About being. And that's why I try to keep my life focused into simply being. Not good, not bad, just to be. And to be able to be where I am and accept that fight. I'm the most wonderful man I've ever been in my life. You know, until I had the chance to kind of move up a mountain, sit way up on the top of the mountain for a little while, and I could look down in the valley where I came from and found there was no difference with you down in the valley than me on top of the hill, then things got okay. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to be different, and didn't realize I walked into a room where everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who gets here wants to be different. It has nothing to do with the color of my skin. I just didn't like what I was. And little by little, by trying to live this program as best I can, the differences have been removed. And today, the language in Alcoholics Anonymous are two simple words. Because I love being unique, and I know my uniqueness will kill me. But the two words that are most important to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is me too. Me too. You may say, well, I've been to jail 10 times. Somebody will come along and say, yeah, well, me too. Somebody will say, I've been married 5 times. And somebody will say, yeah, well, me too. Alcoholics Anonymous, if you stay around here long enough, will steal your uniqueness away from you because it's your uniqueness that will kill you. I am not different. We're all the same. There's no difference in my feelings or a female. None at all. Because feelings are feelings. Feelings have no gender. When you're inadequate, there's no female inadequacy or male inadequacy. You're just inadequate. You know, when you're scared, there's no female fear or male fear. You're just scared. And the best thing you can do is own it. Because I walked around paralyzed with fear. And I came here, and you began to help me replace that fear with faith that God could and would if sought. You did not tell me to find him. Just seek him. And somewhere along the way, he claimed me. He really claimed me. Because I've tried my best to align my will with God's will. And as a result of that, I always finish with this. I'm not going to stop now. I used to talk about freedom. I'm freer today than I've ever been in my life. I'm free of the enemy. That's me. And in that, I have found the hero, and that's me too. There's an old song in slavery they sang, and the words of the song go like this. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me, my Lord. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Those old slaves knew, picking those cotton balls out there in the sun, and all they could hear was excerpts from the Bible from the master who would be delivering the sermon in the church, and the back door would be open so he could see who was working and who wasn't working. And their song was, let me be free. Before I pick another ball of cotton, I'd rather be dead and buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. because they knew where God was, freedom was. Martin Luther King finished one of his many speeches with this. He said, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. Thank you.